All right, we're beginning here on the top of Numenat Aleph. The Mishnayot are following the format that we saw in the first Mishnah that related to Nida. Now we're in different topics, all of which have the same structure, which is that if A is true, then B is true, but not vice versa. Just because B is true doesn't mean that A is true. And so the latest one that we dealt with was Kol HaKasher LaDun, someone who has the ability, capacity, and right to adjudicate, then he's also Kasher La'id. Then they're also fine as a witness, but not vice versa. Just because you are a fine witness doesn't mean that you are a fine judge. To that, the Gemara says, Latuyemai, what is the case that sits in exactly this pivot point where you could be kasher la'id and not kasher la'dun? So, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Latuyay Suma Bachat Me'enav. To include someone who is blind in one eye, Umani, and who's the author of this position is Rabbi Meir, he the Tanya. So now we have the Braita that gives us this Shita of Rabbi Meir. Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Ma Tamud Lomar. What is meant by the Pasuk at the end of Parshat Shoftim, dealing with the Egla Arufa? It says over there, V'nigshu HaKohanim B'nei Levi, Ki Bam Bachar Hashem Elkecha L'Sharato, U'Levarech B'Shem Hashem, V'Al Pihem Yeh Ko Riv V'Chol Naga. So the juxtaposition of Riv and Naga is what the Braita is going to focus on. What does the adjudicating altercations have to do with the sighting of Negaim? Mekish Rivim the Negaim. There's a hekesh between the two of them. Ma Negaim Bayom. Just like Negaim can only be seen by the Kohen during the day. Dichtiv. Ubayom Harod Bo. So on the day that it appears in him. And so you see from that, that the appearance of a Nega, which the Kohen needs to see, is Bayom, during the day. Afrivim Bayom. So too, the adjudication of cases that involve altercations between parties can only be done during the day. Uma Negaim Shelo B'Suma. Just like Negaim cannot be seen by a Suma. Dichtiv, L'chol Mar'e Enei HaKohen. We darshan L'chol Mar'e Enei HaKohen is Deika Kula Mar'e. So he has full vision, so he can see everything. Afrivim Shelo B'Suma. So too, when you're adjudicating altercations between parties, also can't be done with a suma. Umekish nigaim the rivim. And then vice versa. There's a hekesh in the opposite direction, which is, we learn nigaim from rivim. Ma rivim shelo bikrovim. Just like when it comes to a court case, relatives are disqualified from being judges in a case. Af nigaim shelo bikrovim. So too, by nigaim, the kohen can't be a karov of the individual whom he's seeing the nega or paskening on the nega. Ima rivim bishlosha, just like a regular case of altercation which needs three judges to preside over it. Af negaim bishlosha, you would think that negaim also require three kohanim in order to look at it. Vidinu, and it is logical, it's a kal vachomer, mimono bishlosha, it deals with monetary matters. Then we have three judges. Gufo, when it deals with its own personal body, Lo kosher came, wouldn't we want three people looking at it to be certain of the outcome? Tamalomar, there we have an exception because there's a pasuk that declares otherwise. Ruva el Aron HaKohen, ol echad mi banav HaKohanim. Says you'll bring the nega to Aron HaKohen or to one of his children. So the pasuk specifies that one Kohen can deal with the issue. Halamadta. So from this you learn, Shafilo Kohen echad ruet anegaim. Even a single Kohen can take a look at a nega, can paskin on a nega. Now the Kohen really is a prop when it comes to a nega. If he's knowledgeable, then he himself can be machriya with regards to the nega, and he can declare it tamei, tahor, whatever needs to be done with it. On the other hand, if he is ignorant, then you can have a chokham that comes with him that does the hakra, but then you just need the declaration of the Kohen. That's the gzeret hakatub, that the Kohen is the one who declares tamei, tahor. If the Kohen himself doesn't have the capacity to make that decision, you can have someone who makes the decision and then have the Kohen give the psak or say tamei v'tahor. But what you learn from here, this is a braita brought by Rabbi Meir, is there's a correlation between nega and riv. That creates a situation in which, just like by a nega, a suma cannot see the nega, and that's even a suma be'echad me'enav, because over there it says, l'chol mar'ei enei ha'kohen. He has that full vision, full sighting of the nega. Absent that, he can't paskin about the nega. So if you have a hekesh to rivim, the same thing will be true by any judge with the cases of rivim. that he also needs to have full sight in order to be qualified as a judge. It would appear here as well that not only is he disqualified if he's blind in one eye, blind in two eyes, but he's also disqualified if his eyesight is deteriorated. Just like a kohen whose eyesight is deteriorated cannot paskin with regards to a nega, so too with regards to the revim, according to Rabbi Meir. And then that, according to Rabbi Yochanan, is the explanation of our Mishnah, that there are people that are kasher ladun, kasher la'id. On the other hand, there are people who are kasher la'id, but not kasher ladun. And that is a summa b'chat me'enav. A summa that's blind in one eye has the capacity to witness, so he is ra'ah. He saw the events, he can testify that he witnessed those particular events, so he is kasher la'id. Despite the fact that he's kasher la'id, he is not kasher ladun, according to Rabbi Meir. Now, it's interesting that Rabbi Yochanan does this, because Rabbi Yochanan is basically narrowing the scope of this Mishnah, first of all, to a dat yachid, which is Rabbi Meir. Not only a dat yachid, but an unusual case of a summa b'achat me'enav. That means the Mishnah is only true in this unique situation. That's a very narrow case to set up the Mishnah. And the Baal Tosafot say, why don't you set it up in a more simple case, which is the case of ohev and sonet? If the person likes the individual, or the person dislikes the individual. So with regards to testimony, with regards to witnessing, that has no bearing. So even ohev or a sonet can testify, as long as they witness the events. But to be a judge, you're disqualified if you're an ohev, and you're disqualified if you are a sonet. So wouldn't that be the perfect scenario? That's a much more common case than summa b'achat me'enav, and that would be something that you could set up to divrei hakol. Because that's the shita of the Rabbonon in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So why not use that as the situation they explain the Mishnah? So the Baal Tosafot say, first of all, Yesh lomar lo psikale, that that's not a definitive statement, because those individuals are only disqualified from particular cases. They can't be judges. They just can't be judges in this particular case. So they said that's not a good example, and that doesn't fulfill what the Mishnah is looking for. Or someone is kasher la'id, but he's disqualified ladun, period. V'inami, he gives another explanation, which is that the Mishnah cannot be like the Chachamim, because the Mishnah says, kol kasher ladun, kasher la'id. Whoever is kasher to adjudicate is also kasher to witness. And that's a problem for the Chachamim, because as we saw here, Rabbi Meir has a hekesh between Riv and Nega, which tells you that someone who has a problem with their eyesight is disqualified from being a judge. The Chachamim, as we're going to see in a second, do not subscribe to that, and therefore we believe that even a blind person can be a judge. So if that's the case, then the other half of the Mishnah doesn't work. If a blind person can be a judge, he certainly can't be a witness. He has a problem technically, which is he can't witness something in order to testify about it. He's not ra'ah. He doesn't see it, so he can't testify to whatever he saw because he didn't see it, and therefore it wouldn't work according to the Chachamim, because he could be blind and judge, but then he's disqualified from being a witness. For that reason, the Baal Tosafot would also suggest that ohev and sonet would not be a good way to set up the Mishnah, because the other half of the Mishnah doesn't work according to the Chachamim, and that's why Rabbi Yochanan was forced into a corner of explaining the Mishnah according to Rabbi Meir. There are other Rishonim who suggest that the problem of ohev and sonet is not a permanent problem. It's a problem that can go away. It deals with a temporary state of the individual and their feelings towards this particular party. Over time, that could change. We're speaking about something that's posel. We're speaking about something that is a permanent, that's a fixture, not something that wanes and waxes depending on the person's emotions. That's another reason why they don't set it up that way. Or also, it's possible that, according to some of the Rishonim, that ohev and sonet are psulim lechatchila to be done, but b'diavad, if they were done, it would be a kosher din. And that also is different than other types of psulim. That's why Rabbi Yochanan didn't entertain that as a possible explanation for the Mishnah. All right, so that explains why the Gemara follows Rabbi Meir, but that's going to present the problem for Rabbi Yochanan, which is, as the Gemara says now, how Samia d'havei b'shibutei d'Rabbi Yochanan. There was this blind individual in the neighborhood, in the section where Rabbi Yochanan lived, Dava kadayin dina, that he adjudicated cases, velo kamerle, velo mide, and Rabbi Yochanan did not stop him. Now, the Gemara never tells you what type of summa he is, and that leads to machloket in the Rishonim, as to whether we're dealing with a summa b'achat me'enav, he was blind in one eye, or even possibly a summa b'shtei enav. That's the Baal HaTosafot that we just saw, that say that according to the Rabbonon, Suma Bishneinav is Kasher Ladun. According to the Balei HaTosafot, this Suma here could be a Suma Bishneinav. According to the Rambam, this is a Suma Be'achat Be'enav, that they argue on Rabbi Meir with regards to the Hekesh of Nega and Reeve, the Chachamim, but they don't disagree that a Suma Bishneinav is disqualified. The Gemara says, Hechi Abin Hochi. How did Rabbi Yochanan allow that to happen? V'hamer Rabbi Yochanan Alocha Kistam Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan has a general principle in Shas, which causes difficulty in a number of situations, which is he says that Alocha is always like a Stam Mishnah. Our Mishnah is a Stam Mishnah. Or in essence, he is saying Alocha Ki Rabbi Meir. If that's the case, how did he allow a blind person, whether in two eyes or even in one eye, adjudicate cases if he holds like Rabbi Meir based on the Locha Kistam Mishnah? It's non kola kasher ladun kasher la'id, ish kasher la'id ven kasher ladun, which is our Mishnah over here. V'amrinan, and we said about our Mishnah, latuye mai. What does that come to include? Rabbi Yochanan, latuye suma bachat me'enav. So Rabbi Yochanan himself is the one who disqualifies this individual based on the Stam Mishnah, where it says, Rabbi Yochanan, stama achrina ashkach. Rabbi Yochanan found a different Stam Mishnah. He has two Stam Mishnah, yot. It's not dinei memonanot danim biyom v'gomrim balayla. When it comes to monetary matters, you can start the case during the day and finish it at night. You can't start it at night, but if you start it during the day, you can complete the verdict or decision even into the night. That indicates that he does not hold of the hekesh between nega and rivim. Because one of the things that came from nega and rivim was, just like negaim are during the day, or you only see them during the day, so do Rivim can only be adjudicated during the day. And here you have a Mishnah that says otherwise, that it says you can even have the completion of the case at night. That shows you that this Mishnah does not subscribe to that Hekesh. Once you don't subscribe to that Hekesh, you also don't have a disqualification of a Suma. So Rabbi Yochanan hung his hat on that Stam Mishnah, which is a Mishnah that clearly argues on this Hekesh that Rabbi Meir has, where it says, how do you know which Stam Mishnah to pick? There's a Stam Mishnah over here that says, a Suma Bachat Me'enav is disqualified. You have a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that says that he is qualified. So how do I know which one is the better Stam Mishnah? Ivai Deima Stama de Rabbim Adif. That when you have a Stam Mishnah, the one here, which Rabbi Yochanan clearly attributes to Rabbi Meir, makes it a Stam Mishnah of a Dat Yachid. Whereas the Stam Mishnah in Sanhedrin is the Stam Mishnah of the Chachamim's position. So I would favor a Stam Mishnah that is bringing the opinion of the many versus a Stam Mishnah that's bringing the opinion of an individual. And so basically I'm saying Stam Mishnah, but Halacha Kerabim. And therefore I picked the submission of Stam Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Vi by Deima, and this seems to be the more convincing argument, which is Shum Tekani La Gavi Hilchata De Dine. It depends where you find the Stam Mishnah. Here you find a Stam Mishnah in the middle of Nida. This isn't the place where you're dealing with Dinim. This isn't a place where you're dealing with Sanhedrin, where you're dealing with all those matters and laws that deal with Dinim. It's stuck here just because of the genre of the Mishnah. It's not here because this is where the halacha belongs. It's not topically relevant. Whereas in Sanhedrin, that's the proper place for something that deals with Dinim. That's the place where you find the halachot that are dealing with these matters. And if there you have a Stam Mishnah, that's going to carry more weight because that's topically relevant over there. And that's the Stam Mishnah that will govern. And also, the Gemara in other places will use that Gabi Hilchata de Dine. There it's with the topic of Dinim. It also might be in a series of Mishnayot that are giving Piske Halacha. So if you have that as well, that might also favor using a Stam Mishnah in a sequence of Piske Halacha that are definitive. Then we also would pick that Mishnah over another Mishnah that's just found somewhere randomly in Shas. So for those reasons, Rabbi Yochanan favored the Stam Mishnah in Sanhedrin. That Stam Mishnah says that a Suma Be'achat Me'enav at least, or maybe even B'Shteinav, is Kasher Ladun, and that's why Rabbi Yochanan did not stop the individual in his neighborhood from adjudicating cases when he was blind. Our next Mishnah is, Kosh Chayav B'Masrot, Mitamei Tumat Ochlim. Anything that is Chayav and Masrot, for sure can also attain Tumat Ochlim. Or in essence, what you're saying is, there's only Meiser that's taken off of things that are Ochlim. On the other hand, the reverse is not true, which is just because yesh shemitamei tumat ochlim, just because you have a shem ochel and you can have tumat ochlim, eino chayav b'masrot doesn't mean you're chayav in maser. And the Gemara brings the examples: latuye mai, latuye basar, dagim u'beitzim. If all of these items that don't grow from the ground, since they don't grow from the ground, they're not chayav in masrot, and they are still ochel. And being as that they are ochel, they can be mekabel tumat ochlim. So you have meat, fish, eggs. All the things that we make shahakol on are exactly that situation, which means that they can be mekabel tumat ochlim, but they will not be chayav in masrot. And even though the Gemara in Erevin considers animals, gedulei karka, for the ability to purchase them with ma'ot ma'iser sheni, there they make a distinction between gedulei karka, things that grow or sustain from the ground, versus gedulei mina karka, things that grow out of the ground. So even though animals themselves don't grow out of the ground, they're considered gedulei karka because their sustenance and their main source of nutrition comes from the ground. But in the end, they're still not called gedulei mina karka. They don't grow out of the ground, and therefore they're not chayav in masrot. Now the next Mishnah will deal with masrot again, and then we'll figure out exactly what the qualifications are to be chayav in masrot. I'll just postpone it because the Mishnah here is going to deal with it again. Kol shechayav bepeah, chayav in masrot. Anybody who is chayav in the mitzvah of peah is also chayav in the mitzvah of masrot. The reason being that the qualifications to be chayav in peah are more stringent than masrot. They subsume all the qualifications for maser plus more. So that means if you're chayav in peah, you certainly are chayav in masrot. But vice versa is not true. Just because v'yesh chayav in masrot, you're chayav in masrot, does not mean v'eino chayav in peah. Doesn't mean that you are chayav in peah, because the qualifications to meet the threshold to be chayav in peah are higher than those of masrot. This Gemara says latu yemai. What is that coming to tell you about? When it comes to fruits like the fig and vegetables, those are not chayav in peyah. They are chayav in trumot and masrot. At least, as Rashi notes over here, midrabanan. Because Rashi, the Shita Toh, believes that when it comes to trumot and masrot, midoraita, you're only chayav for dagan, tirosh, v'yitzhar, which are grains, grapes and wine, olives and olive oil, those are only things that are chayav midoraita. Midrabanan, you're still chayav for trumot masrot from fruits and from vegetables, but you are not chayav in peyah. It's not, because you have a Mishnah in peyah. Klal amru bepeyah. This is the principle that determines whether you're chayav in peyah. Kol shu ochel. First of all, it's got to be something that is a food. Vinishmar. And people guard it. Meaning it's something of value, by which it just doesn't grow wild in hefker, but it's something that people actually want to keep. They fence off, they keep it private, they are shomeret. V'gidulo min haaretz, it's got to grow from the ground. V'liketoto ke'echad, it's harvested in a single harvest. U'machniso dekiyum, and it can be put into the silo to be stored. Those are the five qualifications to be chayav in peyah, which is you need to have all of these five things to be chayav and peyah. Now the Gemara goes through each one of them to tell you what they exclude. Ochel, it has to be a food item or food substance. Limeute, in order to exclude sfiche, steam or stis, vikotza, woad and matter. From the steam or stis, they take out the blue dye or indigo, and kotza, which is the cartamus tinctoris, so they are able to extract a yellow dye from it. So these are types of dyes, things that grow from the ground, but they're not eaten. So they are something that you might have thought was chayav and peyah because they grow from the ground. On the other hand, they don't have a chiyuv peyah because they aren't ochel. And Rashi writes about these items, v'lo yedana amaynakat svichim. Not exactly sure why it speaks about the aftergrowths. What about the items themselves, the primary items? Why is it only speaking about sfichim? Uchumedumeli, Rashi speculates, sharishonim ru'im la'achila, that the ones that grow originally are edible, and they're used as ochel. It's only the sfichim, it's only the leftover residual matter and woad that are used for dyes. And that's why it says svichim in particular over here. The Bali HaTosafot, they offer an alternative, inami. Svichim ru'im yoter. Maybe they're better as dyes. In that the original growing items don't do as good a job as being dyes versus these items that they find later or that grow in the aftergrowth those tend to have a better quality dye to them. Therefore, they use them for dyes, and that's why it's vinishmar, that it is guarded, that it is kept in private ownership. The mute hefker, that comes to exclude something that's hefker. Vigidulo mina aretz, it grows out of the ground. Limute kemehim upitriot, that comes to exclude like truffles, morels, mushrooms, fungi, anything that grows in that manner is excluded. The Baal Yeh Tosafot discussed this a little bit over here as to why those items are excluded from the din of Pe'ah, because he says, the Gemara tells us in other places, they grow on the ground, but they don't take their sustenance from the ground, they take their sustenance from the air. The problem is that the terminology that's used in the Gemara and other places, as well as over here, is these are things she'ein gidulo min haaretz. Doesn't grow from the ground. That's just not true. These kmeim and pitriot do grow from the ground. They're just not sustained. They don't draw their nutrition from the ground. So then he says, over there in the Gemara, in Brachot, the Gemara amends the statement to say, not gidulo min haaretz, but rather chol davar she'eino yonek min haaretz. Anything that doesn't draw its sustenance or its nutrition from the ground. They changed the phraseology in the Tanaic work there in Brachot to match with this reality. He says, in gain, not be bishmaitin. That's true, then over here in our Gemara they should do the same thing, and it should write, she'eno yonek min haaretz, and not eno gidulo min haaretz, because fame and pitriot do grow on the ground, they just don't draw their nutrition or their sustenance from the ground. Ulikiktato ke'echad, they have to be harvested in a single harvest. Lime'ute te'ena. That was why Teina was left out, because the figs ripen over time. It's not a single point in time where a fig tree ripens. It is a continuous process of ripening, and therefore they don't do the harvest at any singular point in time. That's why Teina is Ptura min ha-peyah. Umachniso le-kiyum, they put it in the silo for storage. Le-meute yerek, that excludes vegetables. Vegetables have no shelf life. They need to be eaten right away, especially in a time period where you have no refrigeration. They certainly can't be kept. They have basically a shelf life of 3 days at most before they go bad when you don't have refrigeration. Even with refrigeration, there is a limited shelf life to vegetables, as opposed to other items that you can, so the kiyum, grains can put in the silo for long duration. So these items are precluded, or excluded from the din of Pe'ah for that reason. So you have Te'ina and Yerek that are left out. Ve'ilu gabay maser tznan, by maser, these are the qualifications for maser. That's what I told you before, we'll see the qualifications. Koshu ochel, similar to peyah, it has a requirement that it be a food substance. Vinishmar, people guard it, it's not from the hefker, it's something that's in private ownership, people put value on it. Vigidulo minaretz, and it grows from the ground. Chayav v'masrot, those are chayav v'masrot. That's different than tumat ochlim, as we saw in the previous Mishnah, because with things like basar, beitzim, and dagim are not gidulam min haaretz. That's why they are not chayav masrot, yet they still are subject to tumat ochlim, because they are ochel. Ve'ilu l'kitato ke'achad u'machniso l'kiyum loktani. These two additional qualifications that you have by peyah don't exist by masrot. And that's what creates the statement in our Mishnah, which is anything that's chayav and peyah, by definition, will be chayav and masrot. Because the three qualifications to be chayav and masrot are subsumed in the five qualifications that you have by peyah. But vice versa would not be true. Just because you're chayav and masrot doesn't mean that you meet the threshold for peyah, because there are only three qualifications to meet the threshold of masrot. For peyah, you need to hit five. So you could have them be chayav and masrot, but be missing the threshold that would make you chayav and peyah. And the examples of that are Te'ina and Yerek. Those are exactly the items whereby they are chayav and masrot, but they are turim min ha-peyah. The Baal Yeh Tosafot over here asks an interesting question, which is, the chiyuv masrot with regards to Te'ina and Yerek is only midrabanan. So the Rabbanan instituted masrot and trumot masrot by Te'ina and Yerek. Why did they only have that institution by masrot and not by peyah? If you're talking about the Doraita level, then make it that Te'ina v'Yerek are Pturim in a Trumot Masrot, and they're Pturim in a Peyah. They should have no Chiyuv in either case. So then why is it that the Chachamim instituted a Chiyuv Trumot Masrot by Te'ina v'Yerek, and they did not institute a Din of Peyah? So the Rabbeinu Tam over here gives the same answer in both instances, both for Te'ina and for Yerek, which is, it was not worthwhile for the aniyim. Because peah is only given when you finish whatever you are harvesting and you leave the last part of it over. So if the ani hangs around waiting for the fig tree, number one, they won't be done harvesting it for a long time. On even a given day or a given point in time when they harvest it, that which is left over is minimal because they don't harvest the whole thing in one shot. And therefore, it would be to the detriment of the ani if they instituted peah by the figs, because he'd end up waiting for the figs and giving up opportunities in other places that would be much more lucrative to him. Therefore, they did not institute it by peah. And similarly, he says, by yerek, because yerek, first of all, only has a limited amount that is harvested, not like big fields of grains. And on top of that, it only has limited shelf life. So again, it's not worthwhile for the ani to hang around to get the few scraps of the vegetables in the corner at the end. It doesn't pay off, and Chazal felt that they had better opportunities waiting for peah somewhere else, and that's why they did not institute peah in the case of Teina and Yerek, even though they did institute Trumot and Masrot. Now the Gemara gets a little bit sidetracked, but it has a big nafkamina, the halacha. It says, V'im ayubahem shumim ubitzalim, if it has amongst them garlic and onions, chayavin, then they are chayav. So obviously we're picking up in the middle of a statement, and that is that these are items that do get put into the kiyum. Meaning, as opposed to normal vegetables that have no shelf life, garlic and onion can be stored. And therefore, they are chayavin in peah, as opposed to other types of vegetables. It's not milabnot bisalim sheben ayerek. The way Rashi translates it is that these are rows of onions in between the rows of vegetables. Although the word malbein means a square area, I mean these are areas that are planted onions in between other areas that have yerek in them. Rabbi Yossi omer peah mikol achat veachat. You have to take off a separate peah from each row or each section because we don't consider them to be a field. We consider each one to be independent. And therefore you have to leave peah from each one because the anim are waiting to see and they see one row and they think that you're done with it. Not all the alternating rows or different sections where you have the onions. So therefore, you have to give peah from each one of them individual. Still can give peah, one peah for all of them there, even though they're not adjacent to each other, even though they're dispersed in the field. You can still take off one peah because they're visible for each other. And you can see the different rows. And therefore, the ani knows that he's not going to get peah until you finish all those rows of onions. Those are the vegetable exceptions to the rule with regards to peah, because over there, they do have shelf life to them. What actually comes out of here is a very interesting halacha that the Baalei Tosafot bring here and a number of other places in Shas, which has a big nafkamina today with regards to Trumot and Masrot. So Tosafot brings over here, V'im tomar, ha'amrina beperek kamad chulin. We have in the first perek of chulin, you don't have to worry about the sourdough and the spices that are in it. Lo mishum maser, velo mishum shvi'it. Not to take off Trumot and Masrot, and not to worry about Dinei Shvi'it. Mashma, de Maser Noheg bit Tavlin. That makes it sound like Masrot are relevant by Tavlin. Just happens to be in that case, they are a minority or they are Batel, so you don't have to worry about them. But that means in another circumstance, you would be Chayav in Maser. Vim Keim Itamei Tumat Ochlim. That's the case, then our Mishnah dictates when you're Chayav in Masrot, that means by definition, you are also Tamei Tumat Ochlim. Yet, Ba'or Barotev, which we learned later on in Chulin, it says that the items there at the bottom of the pot, which are the kippah and the tavlin that are mixed at the bottom of the pot, they have a din of Tumat Ochlim, Aydei Tziruf. But together with the meat and the other items that are cooked in the pot, they extend the Ochlim to that category. But it sounds like, absent that Tziruf, those spices and those things that found at the bottom of the pot would not have Tumat Ochlim. So it sounds like if they don't have Tumat Ochlim, then it's not true that they're Chayavin B'Maser. The Tosafot says, I have a stira here. Sometimes the Gemara seems to indicate that spices are Chayav in Trumot Maserot. In other places they say that spices don't have any din of Tumat Ochlim, so certainly don't have any din of Trumot and Maserot. How do I reconcile that? Tosafot's reconciliation is actually halakhically normative. Today, which is Yesh Lamar, Dika Bet Minim Tavlin. There are two different types of spices. There are certain spices that are used solely for that purpose, which is to spice. That they, all they do is give flavor to an item. they're not eaten independently. Those types of spices are not metamei tumat kol klim, and they're not chayav in trumot and masrot. But there are tavlin de'ruin nami b'fnatzman. They can be eaten alone, and they're also made to give flavor. Kigon, the example he brings is shumim u'bitzalim, garlic and onion. Garlic and onion, you can eat them independently. People eat them all the time. They eat the cooked onions. They eat fried onions. They eat garlic that is cooked. Yet they also use it as a spice. There's onion powder, garlic powder. That type of spice will be chayav b'maser and will be matamei tumat ochlim. So the combination of the Mishnah before and what we're saying here about the shumim b'tzalim shows, Tosafot says, that there are spices that you are chayav in trumot u'masrot for, and there are other spices where you're not. And it depends on the utility of the item. If the item has utility aside from being a spice, which means that it's eaten independently, or it's eaten as is, if that's the case, then you would be chayav in trumot u'masrot. The examples he brings are onions and garlic. A great example is basil. Basil, which people put fresh basil leaves into a salad, into a dish, and people eat the basil leaf whole. There's also flavoring, basil flavoring, and basil spice, that people use it in that manner as well. That would be chayav in trumot u'masrot, because people eat it in a salad. Other things like thyme, where people don't eat it plain, they only use it as a spice, that will not be chayav in trumot and masrot. That distinction is a very important distinction, which has halachic ramifications with regards to this. Tosfot at the end discusses that, these types of ideas. He says that, for instance, pepper, something that's ground up into a spice, like pepper, nobody eats that spice independently. They only use it with something else. He says, as opposed to the zera gargir, which he mentions over here, which even after people grind it up, they still eat it plain as a ground item, not just as in a dip, or not just as a spice. So he says it's very particular. He's giving you principles here as to where to determine where something will be chayav in trumot u'masrot, which is something, just a nafkamina that comes out of our Gemara over here. Tosafot mentions it in Chulin as well. I've seen it quoted a number of times, Alocha, this distinction about spices. Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ushin, endives, Shizaran mitchila debeima, endives that were grown originally to be feed for animals, benim lachaleim le'adam. Then he changed his mind later on and decided he wanted them for human consumption. It's become more popular in the modern era to eat ushin, despite the fact that they're very bitter and difficult to eat alone. They do it with dressings and dips and in salads to accompany the flavoring. If you do that, tzrichot makshava kishetelshu. You have to have in mind when they are severed from the ground, when they are picked, you have to have makshava that you're going to use it for ochel. Kasavar, it seems from here, that makshevet chibur lo shma makshava. That when you have a makshava, when it's still attached to the ground, it has no impact. Because when it's attached to the ground, there's no din of tumat ochlim. Because tumat ochlim only applies to things that are severed, that are removed from the ground. When you mechuba the karka, there is no din of tumat. So your makshava during that period of time is not meaningful. So you have to have that makshava in order to change it, convert it into something that is ochel, something that is considered to be a food item or food substance. Now Tosafot says over here, he says, mashma d'stama l'adam kaimet. Sounds like ocean endives. Otherwise, if you planted them, we would assume that they were for human consumption, unless you specify that they are for animal consumption, or at least they're for both. Stama, and that's enough to make you chayav in shumot masrot, if you don't specify up front that you're planting them for animals. So now, despite the fact that they have a dual utility, both for man and animal, when you have in mind up front to plant them for animals, it's influential and takes away the shame ochel from them because you planted them in particular for an animal. And even though we have the principle that we saw in Kretot, that anything that can be eaten by human beings, then it is not pasul me'achila until it's pasul me'achilat kelev. And it has a din of ochel. But here, based on our Gemara, it tells you that when you designate it for animals, it loses its shame, ochel adam. So even though normally if you planted this, it would be for human consumption, or at least for human and animal consumption, but you specifically specify for animal consumption, you take away its sad that it is for human consumption. And that's why you need a makshava in the back end to change it back into ochel. You're able to remove the same ochel from it if you have it in mind originally. So either you have to say that when you plant it for behemah, it precludes the aspect of human consumption from it, or you have to say that hechsher for animals is not considered to be a hechsher for Adam. Those are the two ways that the Baal Tosafot will deal with it. And that's why we need a separate machshava to change it back into ochel in order for it to be mekabel tumat ochlim. And the specification here is kishit lashu, that only when it's detached can you do that, because while it's attached, it can't be mekabel tumat. So your machshava during that period of time is not meaningful. It's amarava. Afana namitanina. I can show you that that's true. Yud Gimel Dvarim Nemru B'Nevelat Of Tahor. The Gemara is going to spare us here and not bring the entire list over here of 13 things which are true by a Nevelat Of Tahor, kosher bird that dies, not by Shechita. V'zeh Echad Mehem. And this is one of those 13, which is what the Gemara is after. Tzricha Machshava V'Einat Tzricha Hechsher. It needs Machshava to turn it into Ochel, but it does not require Hechsher, as Rashi says over here. It doesn't require a liquid to prime it to be mekabel tumah, as well as it doesn't require outside tumah to make it tameh. It's inherently tameh, and doesn't require an outside item to make it tameh. So that's what it means, ein tzricha hechsher. Doesn't require hechsher mekabel tumah, and doesn't require hechsher tumah either. But what you see from here is it needs machshava. Alma machshevet chayim lo shma machshava. The machshava to eat it while it's alive is not sufficient. Hakaname machshevet chibur lo shma machshava. So too by the vegetation, when you have a machshava, when it's attached to the ground, it is not sufficient. As Tosafot explains over here, that michayim lo chishev lo ochla ad achar shchita. When it was alive, your intent in terms of eating it was after you shecht it, you will eat it. But instead of shechting it, it ended up dying. The Rashi just says it more simply, which is the fact that since it can't be mekabel tuma now, any machshava during this period of time is not meaningful. You have to have a machshavat ochlim when it has the possibility of being mekabel tumat ochlim. As Tosafot sees it as being a long-range view as how you consider it to be ochel. You only consider it to be ochel because you assumed you were going to shecht it. Now that it got to being an ochel in a different manner, then you need a separate machshava to bring about the fact that it's ochel, because it didn't follow the path of the machshava that you thought would have made it into ochel. So now, if it was considered to be a machshava, then it wouldn't matter that it died, because you originally had in mind to eat it after shechita. If that was a sufficient machshava, then when it dies, you still would have that din in place, and it would be ochel. The fact that now we require you a new machshava to make it into ochel shows you the machshava that when you had it when it was alive is not meaningful. And when it's alive, it's not mekabel tumah. So what Rava says is these are parallel cases. By animals, when they're alive, they're not mekabel tumah, and your machshava is not meaningful during that period of time. So too by the vegetation. When it's in the ground, it's not mekabel tumah. Therefore, your machshava during that period of time will not be meaningful. Rabbi Zeira Amar, hacha begozal shenafal min arum askinan. This is a case where it's a bird that fell out of the sky. The lava come on. That wasn't in front of us, the lachshovale, so that we could have had it in mind. You can say that if you had the item here beforehand, the kosher bird, it was a chicken in your yard, you intended to shecht it to eat it, and then instead it died. So there, that machshava might be meaningful and might have impact. So then what's the Mishnah speaking about? About Yudgivel Dvarim by Nevelat Of, that says that you need machshava. That's a case where the bird wasn't in front of us, wasn't here beforehand. For instance, you're walking down the road and all of a sudden you bump into it and you see a dead chicken on the road. So now, in order for that to become ochel, you'd have to have a machshava on it. Or something falls out of the sky and it wasn't there beforehand for you to have a machshava or intent to eat it. So it never had a shame ochel on it, even when it was alive. And therefore, you need a machshava once it's dead to make it into ochel. So Rabbi Zera takes away this proof that Rava brings by saying that the case there is different. The case there is it may not have been available to us beforehand for you to have a makshavet ochel. But had you had it beforehand and you had the makshavet ochlin, maybe it would have been sufficient even before it died. Amalei Abaye. So Abaye says, Tarnagolet shebiyavna ma'ika lemeimar. Okay, that works well for your case that we're seeing over here. In the case of Nevelat Of, you can make it so that it's a narrow situation. But we have case law, which we're going to bump into in a minute, with regards to the case of a chicken in Yavne, where they made the chicken into something that was considered to be ochlin, and it was tamei tumat ochlim, and there it was clearly in front of us beforehand. It wasn't something that fell out of the sky. We'll see the case later on. And the chicken in general is a domesticated animal, and therefore it was not something that was wild, and they had makshava on it beforehand. So that undermines Rabbi Zera's position. So Mike and the main marmalade, tanagol bara haba. It was a wild chicken. So it wasn't around beforehand. It only showed up now. Achiku ale. They laughed at that answer that Rabbi Zera gave. Tanagol bara of tamehu. The wild chicken is a non-kosher bird. So then, what's the story? This is about a nevelat of tahor, and you're telling us something about a non-kosher chicken? Of tamei, mika mitamo. And of tamei, what do you need heksher and makshava for? It is mitamei, because it's a nevela. And it has its own inherent tumah that has nothing to do with makshava. So then why would that be the case in Yavne, where they speak about individuals having makshava to make it into ochel? Amarlo Abaye. Abaye says back to Talmidim, Gavra Rabba Amar Milta, Lo Techiku Ale. A big gun says something, don't laugh about it. He must have meant something, we gotta figure out what he meant. We can't make fun of him and just say, he made a mistake, he's talking about a non-kosher bird. That doesn't make any sense. Rather, Betana Golet, Shemarda, he's talking about a chicken that rebelled. Umay Bara, so that what does it mean? It's wild or it's out in the wild. Deivrai Mimara. It ran away from its owner, decided it wanted to be independent, wanted to live out in the wild. So sometimes you have domesticated animals like a chicken that end up being in the wild because they escaped, they ran away. They like life in the free range rather than being cooped up. If it's wild, then maybe people did not have in mind to eat it beforehand, and that's why you need a makshava. So then that case in Yavne does not undermine Rabbi Zera's position. But Papa Amar, that Rabbi Zera was referring to a tarnagolata de agma havai. It is the chicken that lives in the swamps, out in the fields, in the wild, but it is a kosher bird. And Rabbi Papa le tame, Rabbi Papa's the shitato, Dama Rabbi Papa, tarnagol de agma asur. The male chicken that's found in the agma is problematic. Tarnagolota de agma, the female chicken that's found out in the agam, sharia is mutar, is kosher. Besimaneich, and the way to remember it is, Amoni, velo Amonit, by the Moabites and the Ammonites, the females are allowed to join Klal Yisrael, but the males are not allowed to join Klal Yisrael. And so you can remember the same thing, that the Tarnagolata, the female of the Agma is kosher, the male is not kosher. Tosafot is perplexed by this. How do you have such a situation where in the same species, the male is not kosher, and the female is kosher? What happens when they reproduce? What happens when they lay eggs and they fertilize eggs? The offspring, what's the din? So Tosafot comes out with an answer in both cases where he asks this question. He says it's an egg. And an egg doesn't have attribution to the parents. That's because the chicken lays the egg. And he says it grows up by itself in the ground. Or basically you incubate it. And the incubation is what makes the animal grow. It really doesn't come from the parent. He said that with regards to the female. And even with regards to the fertilization, again, the egg grows by itself. It's independent of the parents, and therefore it doesn't have the same status as the parents. It's interesting only because it's clear that whatever was inside of the egg was laid by the mother, and that the father's contribution is no less than any other animal where the father fertilizes the egg. And yet Tosafot thinks because it grows out and it matures, incubates outside the mother, maybe that makes it independent of the parents, and the offspring can be kosher as long as they are females. Then Tosafot backs away from that and says, that seems to be a little crazy. And he says that it must be that these are two different species. It happens to be that one of them is called Tarnagolata, and one is called Tarnagol. But that's not to say that one is male, one is female. It means the males and the females of the Tarnagol are Daagma species, and the males and females of the Tarnagolata, Daagma species, those that are from Tarnagolata are Sherim, and those that are from Tarnagol are not Sherim, and they're just two different species. Darash Mereimar, Tarnagolata Dagma Asira. So Mereimar disagreed with Rav Papa and said what the Baal HaTosafot were now calling the species of Tarnagolata Dagma is actually not kosher, because Chazur Rabbanon, Rabbanon got sight of it, the Darsa Ve'achla, it does drisa, which is one of the four items that make it into a bird that is tamei. There are four simanim for a bird to be tamei. One of them is drisa, v'hainu giruta, and that is the giruta, which is the moor hen, a type of non-kosher bird. Now Rashi over here brings two possibilities as to what drisa means, and that has obviously major implications for kosher and non-kosher birds. Rashi says, first of all, Darsayas mikabelet biraglea mashochelet. When food comes to it, it grabs it by its feet and not by its mouth. It grabs it by its claws, not by its mouth. That's one version of what Rashi says is darsa, that it doesn't eat directly with its beak or with its mouth. It grabs whatever it's going to eat with its feet. Like, for instance, when you have birds that go into the water and pull out fish with their feet, that's an indication. That's darsa. That's one. Vani Omer, Rashi says, I think that's not the right explanation. Said the reset, but rather, Vani Omer says, the reset al machla biragleha. It stands on its food with its claws, lechos, to hold it in place, shlo yavo kulo lepia. So it doesn't eat it all at once. Vein of tahora sekein. A kosher bird doesn't do that. So even though chickens eat everything, and they even eat worms, when they go eat a worm, they just go to the ground and they pull it into their beak and they take it in. Birds that are dores, that are birds of prey, they hold down whatever they're going to eat and they tear it apart. They pull with their beak, but the counter pressure they're pulling with the beak is their claw. And that's what Rashi says is dores. Dores means it stands on its food in order to allow it to pull away pieces of the food without it taking the whole thing into its mouth. So Rashi gives two definitions of drisa, which obviously we'll have nafkaminot as to whether birds are considered to be kosher or tamei, depending on whether they have these features or not. Rashi favors heavily saying drisa has to do with standing on it and then being torn apart. Mareimar says the Chachamim got sight of this Tarnagolot, the Agma, that was eating in this fashion, and therefore they decided that it's definitely a non-kosher species. And the species that they determined it is the Giruta. It's a moor hen, and that is considered to be not kosher, according to Mareimar. Tarabanan. Gozal shnafal legat. There was a bird that fell into a wine press, and the press is gathered all the wine there, and all of a sudden you have this dead bird that's a kosher, but dead bird that falls in there wasn't shechted. V'chishei malav lahaloto lekuti. If he had in mind to take it out and feed it to the non-Jews, tamei, then it has a problem of tumat uchlim, because you had a machshava to use it for uchlim. And that machshava now makes it that it's susceptible to tumat uchlim. And again, because of that machshava, you won't need a hekshar because of the fact that it's so full of tamei tumah chamura, which we're going to see in a second. Lekelev tahor, if he tends to take it out and feed it to his dog, then it doesn't have a din of tumat uchlim, because it's not ra'oi la'achilat adam, it's only ra'oi la'achilat kelev. That's what you're taking it out for. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri Omer, af lekelev tamei. It doesn't matter, even if you intend to take it out for your dog, it is tamei. And not that Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri believes that machshavat kelev has any impact. He just believes that you don't need machshava at all, as we're going to see now. I'm Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, kal v'chomer. I'll tell you why I think that's the case. Im etamei tumah chamura shelo b'machshava. If it's able to metamei tumah chamura without any machshava, that is nevelat of tahor, the way that it conveys its tumah, is not through maga and masa, not coming into contact with it, not carrying it. It has to do with swallowing it. When you swallow the nevela tof tahor, it makes you tamei and makes your clothing tamei. So that's the case of where it makes you tamei. And there it doesn't need hechsher, doesn't need machshava, doesn't need anything. The mere fact that you ate it makes you tamei, even if you didn't know it was a nevela tof tahor. Even if nobody ever thought about it to be a ochel, it's still mitamei you. Im mitamei tumat chamura shelo b'machshava, lo yitamei tumat kala shelo b'machshava, then certainly it should be able to have tumat ochlim without any machshava. Amru lo, the Chachamim respond to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, lo, that's not the case. Im amarta b'tuma chamura, shekein eno yoredet lekach, by tuma chamura, it never reaches that point. We'll see in tomorrow's daf what that means. The easiest way to explain it, and that's what the Bali Tosafot asks in tomorrow's daf, which is, why didn't the Gemara explain it this way? Which is, by tuma chamura, you never need machshava. Since you never need machshava over here, of course you don't need machshava. Tumar b'tumah kala shekein yored lekach. On the other hand, when it comes to tumah tochlim, you always need machshava. So why should this be an exception to the case? Tumah chamura never needs machshava. Tumah tochlim require machshava. So what type of kavachomer is that? oh, if you don't need makshava by tumat chamura, it's certainly you don't need makshava by tumat oklim. So it's not true. They're different categories, and those categories, one requires makshava, one does not require makshava. Arm of the hand, tarna golet shibyabna tochiach. This is the case that we quoted before with regards to questioning Rabbi Zeira, that the case of tarna golet in Yavna will prove that I'm right. She already dekach, that it does have this feature, vitam ua shalobi makshava, and they made it tamei even without any makshava, meaning that they found these kosher birds that were dead, and yet the chachamim determined that they have tumat ochlim. Well, that makes it sound like exactly the case that we're looking for. You have a bird that will reach a higher level of tuma when it's swallowed, when it's eaten, and before that point in time, it was deemed to have tumat ochlim, even though there was no makshava. Amru lo shmisham raya. You want to bring a proof from the case in Yavne? Kutim ayusham. There were non-Jews there. V'chishvu aleh le'achila. And they intended to eat it. They were going to eat it, and that's what made it into tumat ochlim. There was makshava. Happened not to be the Jews, but the non-Jews that were present at the time that the animals died or found the animals that were dead, they intended to eat it, and therefore the nevelat of tor had tumat ochlim. Not automatically, but because there was a makshava. It says, b'mayaskina, where exactly is the scenario here where you have a requirement for makshava with regards to a nevelat of tor? Ilema b'krachim, if you're in the major cities, lamala b'makshava, why do you even need makshava? V'atnan, you have a mishnah, nevelat behema tehora, a kosher animal that dies, that carcass, b'chol makom, is considered to be ochlin, because people eat these items when you're in the big cities, and therefore it's for sure going to be used as ochel, and that's as if it has a makshevet ochlim associated with it, because it's ochel. Certain items that are ochel, you don't need to have makshevet ochlim, because they are inherently ochel. And that's what the Mishnah is saying, that a nevela of a behemah Torah is considered to be something that's ochel. Unevelat of tahor, and as well as the nevelot of a kosher bird, vachelev, and fats that are asurim, bikrachim, ein tzrichim, lo makshava, lo ekshir. When you're in the city, you don't need a makshava to make it into ochlim. They are automatically ochlim. And you don't need ekshir, because all these items are so full, it's a tumah tuma chamura. In the end, they will create higher level tuma by the nevela itself, the nevela as tuma. And by nevela doftor, when you swallow it, it will create tuma chamura. So you don't need ekshir. And you don't need makshava because you're in the big city. And as Rashi says over here, Rashi and Chulin, when he spoke about this, gave a number of different reasons for this. Over here, Rashi brings the one of those reasons, which is Dika Amrav Bochlimakol. There are numerous people there. The populations are big in the cities, and therefore everybody eats these items. Rashi and Chulin brings this as one of the reasons, which is there is a shortage of food given the amount of population in the cities. Therefore, they eat all of these items because they have no choice. They need to feed a lot of people. And therefore, these items become food substances in the big cities. Rashi, in another place, notes that because they're wealthy in the cities, they end up eating these items because they're wealthy. It's interesting why exactly that would be. But Rashi notes that in other places in Chulin as being the reason for the big cities not requiring makshava. So if that's the case here, if we're in Yavna, it's considered or classified as a big city, then why do they need makshava at all? Ela bikfarim, it's in the villages. Umi, ikar in the mandamar, the lobai makshava. Well, it's in the village. Is there anybody who says otherwise, that you don't require makshava? How could it be that Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri is making a suggestion here that you didn't need makshava? When it comes to the villages, Vatznan, the Mishnah says, nevelat behemat mea, the carcass of a non-kosher animal, b'chol makom, anywhere you go, you need a makshava to make it an ochlim. It does not have a default status of ochlim. As Rashi notes over here, and we discussed more extensively in Kulin, the belief was that if ve'lat ve'mat me'ah, nobody, not even non-Jews, would eat such an item because it's ma'us. And therefore, you need active makshava to turn it into ochel or make it into something that people would consider ochel. Unevelat oftahor bakfarim. When it comes to a kosher bird that is a nevela that died and wasn't shechted, that bird in the kfarim, in the villages, requires tzricha makshava and tzricha hekshir. It needs a makshava to make it into ochlim, because, as Rashi says, in the villages, there aren't so many people eating. Since there aren't so many people eating, they don't need to eat everything. They don't need so much supply of food, and therefore they'll pass on this type of item, like an avelat of tahor. Or because the Rashi says in the Gemara Chulin that they are poor, and therefore they're not going to be buying these types of items because they have limited resources, and these aren't the types of things that they're going to pay for or buy or keep around. Now, once you have the machshevet ochlim, it automatically becomes tamei, because again, it's sofol the tamei tumah chamura. In the end, it's going to become a very high level of tumah, and that high level of tumah affects it even before it reaches that point of high level tumah. When you swallow it, it'll make you tamei tumah chamura. Therefore, even when it is before that point in time, it has tumah automatically associated with it when it's determined to be an ochel. Tosafot just makes a note about the girsa here that the word chelev is found in the situation with regards to the city, but it's not found in the case of the kfarim. And that is because by the cities, it could be chelev from a beima to hura, which was mukshar, either the shchita of the animal, and therefore it doesn't need a machshevet ochlim afterwards. Whereas by the kfarim, of course, you would require machshava in the kfarim for chelev. You would require hechsher, and that's different than the situation of nevelat of tahor, where you need machshava, but you don't need hechsher. By chelev, you would need hechsher, because there's no automatic hechsher, as opposed to by the krachim, where the shechita does that. That's because by the krachim, it's already an ochel before the shechita, therefore the shechita is makshirit. By the kfarim, it's not an ochel before the shechita, therefore the shechita can't be makshirit. And therefore, when you have the machshava later on, it will also require a hechsher. And that's why Tosafot says there should not be a girsa of nevelat of tahor and chelev in the Mishnah that deals with kfarim. And you see here that the Mishnah says if you're in the kfarim, you need a machshava. So what exactly is this scenario in Yavne? If it's in the city, you don't need machshava, and nobody thinks you need machshava, so why do you need machshava at all? According to the Chachamim. If it's in the village, how do you get away without having a machshava? I'm Rav Zira Bar Chanina, Dolam Bikrach. It was in the city, Vigito Me'asto, and the press where the bird fell into made it disgusting, Baso Kikafar, and made it like as if it was in the village. So in Achanami, it was a city, and in the city, you wouldn't need Makshava to make an Ochlim, but automatically would have been Ochel. The only problem is that this isn't your typical Nevelat Of Tahor. It's a Nevelat Of Tahor that's been floating around in grape juice or wine for a period of time, and it's ruined it. And therefore, now it becomes something that does not have the default status of ochel, and you would have to actively engage to make it into ochel. You'd need positive makshava to make it into ochlim, because otherwise we would assume that it's disgusting enough that people would not eat it. And even though everybody requires a makshava in the kfarim, it's clear that Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri does not subscribe to that because he has the kal v'chomer. And then what's exactly the Gemara's question? So Balei Tosfot suggests that the Gemara is asking this on the Rabbonan Shita, which seems to indicate that only because it fell into the gut do they need a machshava. But had it not fallen into the gut, it wouldn't need a machshava. And yet we're dealing with the case where we're in the villages. So if that's the case, then why would you only require it in the gut? You would require it even out of the gut. And that's before we come to the conclusion that the gut is equal to kfarim, and therefore you can't make that diok anymore, that in the gut, yes, and the kfarim, no, because the gut is the kfarim. Now Rashi over here notes, why is it important that these items have tumat ochlim associated with them? I understand by nevelat of tahor, it doesn't have any tumah until it's swallowed. So therefore, to have tumat ochlim is impactful before that period of time. But a regular nevelat that was mentioned in the Mishnah that we brought from Uksin, why is it that you require by the nevelat of beimat Torah or the nevelat of beimat Meah, which inherently have tumat nevelat, why does it matter that you give it tumat ochlim? They are inherently problematic. The Rashi brings here, the Gemara notes in other places, it has a nafkamina for tziruf, to add them together with other items. Tumat nevela only conveys tumah, is only problematic if you have a kezayit worth of nevela. If you have less than a kezayit of nevela, it's not impactful in terms of tumah, it's below the threshold shiur. So if you had a below the threshold shiur of nevela veima, which would then not convey tumah, it matters if it's ochlin. Because if it's considered ochlin, it could join together with other ochlim to meet the minimum standard of a kabeitza for tumat ochlim. We've discussed many times the machlok between Rashi and the Tosafot as to what the kabeitza is, whether the kabeitza is the size that conveys tumat, or is kabeitza even the size to accept tumat ochlim. But nevertheless, it will help you when it's joined together with other Ochlim to reach that minimum shiur of a kebetza. So that's why there's a nafkamina, that even though the ve'la itself is inherently tamei, there is a nafkamina if it has tumat Ochlim on it, because then it can be mitzaref with other Ochlim in order to make the minimum shiur of a kebetza. And you can see in Rashi over here that he says, umekabela tuma, that size of a kebetza is what allows it to receive tuma. You see Rashi saying over here that you need a kebetza not only to convey tuma toklim, but even to receive tuma toklim. I've also noted before, Rashi is suter himself in a number of places in Shas, and the Balei Tosafot have a sheet of the Rabbeinu Tam versus the Balei Tosafot that also argue about exactly this point. Where in the Rabbeinu Tam, like Rashi over here, thinks that you need a kebetza for kabbalat tuma, not just for conveyance of tuma. Now the Gemara goes back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and says, "I'm Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, kal v'chomer. Imitama tuma chamura shalo b'machshava, lo titame tuma kala shalo b'machshava." That's his kal v'chomer. Amru lo lo. They said to him, "Ima marit b'tuma chamura shekein eno yuredet dekach." It never has that issue. My eno yuredet dekach. What does it mean that it never has that issue? Amarava achikamri le. This is what the Chachamim are saying to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Lo ima marit b'tuma chamura. Because it doesn't create something at the same level of tuma as it itself is. Tomar b'tuma kala sho'osa k'yotzeba. That the tuma kala can create tuma at the same level at which it is tameh. That is meaning that if an avela is mitmei adam, and avela is an abu tuma, it's mitmei adam, it makes a person into a rishon the tuma. That person can't go and be mitameh another person. Because a human being can only become tameh from an abba tumah, can't become tameh from a rishon the tumah. So if the nevela is an abba tumah, the person is a rishon the tumah, if he touches someone else, that someone else is not tameh, because a rishon doesn't make a human being tameh. On the other hand, if you have tumat ochlim, then ochel chozer mitameh ochel midrabanan. Ochlim can be mitameh other ochlim, at least rabbinically. And therefore you have a kiyotseba, it affects an item that is similar to it. Ochlim that have a certain level of tuma, they can affect another piece of ochel and make it tameh. As opposed to an adam that got tameh from an avela, they can't convey the tuma to another person. Amarle Abaye, Abaye says to Rava, kol dechenu, that is a koshekein. Uma tuma chamura dekilo. If you're telling me by a tuma chamura, which is less stringent, because it can't convey tuma to a person for that person to convey tuma to someone else. And despite that, it doesn't require a makshava, tuma kala, by the lighter forms of tuma, tuma tochlim, the chamira, that has a chumra with it, the osek yotzeba, that it does make things similar to it, tamei, similar items to it, tamei, enudin shemitama v'shloba makshava, and certainly, when it has this chumra, it certainly then should be mitama shelo b'machshava. It only serves to enhance the kal v'chomer of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and not undermine it. So that can't be the explanation. El Amar of Sheshet, Hachi Kamar. This is the explanation of the Chachamim's rejection of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Lo imamart b'tuma chamura shekein eina tzricha hechsher. By tuma chamura, where it doesn't require hechsher, meaning that it might not require makshova, but it also does not require hechsher, not priming for tuma, and not to become tameh. It becomes tameh inherently. Tumar b'tuma kala, by tuma kala, shetzricha hechsher, it requires hechsher. It requires priming to become tameh, and it requires some other tuma to touch it to make it tameh. So if that's the case, then tuma kala is very different than tuma chamura. Tuma chamura is inherent tuma to it. Since it has inherent tuma, maybe that's why you don't need a makshava. Whereas by ochlim, where it doesn't have inherent tuma to it, that's maybe why you need a makshava over there. If that's the case, you can't draw a kal v'chomer. Alright, we're gonna stop here, 10 lines down on the top of Nun Aleph Amud Aleph, and we'll continue with the Gemara challenging this version of the Chachamim according to Rav Sheshet, where he says that the difference is whether they need hechsher or they don't need hechsher. And the Gemara will ask tomorrow, does tuma kala, do tuma toklim really require hechsher?